This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to the podcast of The Petri Dish on Joy 94.9.
Petri dish, noun. A small, shallow dish of thin glass or plastic with a loose cover used especially for cultures in bacteriology. Petrie was an assistant to the eminent bacteriologist Robert Koch. In 1887, Petrie introduced a vessel for growing bacteria that consisted of two round rim plates, one serving as a cover for the other Petri dish.
You're listening to The Petri Dish on Joy 94.9. Hope you all had a good Easter. Did you have a good Easter, Wendy?
I had a very good Easter. I was thinking a lot. You know what thinking involves?
Yes, thinking involves your brain.
Your brain, that's right, which is
nice,
the topic.
Nice segue there.
Oh, thanks. No worries. We could have talked about eggs or bunny rabbits, but no. The brain.
The brain. And the brain, this is dedicated to our producer's friend Kane and my friend Tom, who had a little bit of a brain injury recently. And he wanted to know a lot about the brain, so this is dedicated to him.
So we're going
to
tell him, we're going to talk about how the brain works and what is a neuron.
Yeah, so we're going to talk, our controversy today is studying brain diseases and animal models. Do we really need to use animals to study the brain?
I'm excited to learn about that. Shane's going to tell us about that. And our myth today is that hitting your head can cause brain damage. So we'll talk about whether that is a myth or a fact.
And we're also going to talk about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Can we erase our memory of just one person?
Oh, I did love that movie. I would hate to think that it was all a lie.
Oh, we'll see. We'll see, Wendy. We'll see very soon. But first up, today's an all-Australian music show, I think.
That's right.
Or mostly Australian.
I'm very excited.
And we're going to start off with a Melbourne band called Two Cents Sideshow with Wishbone. You're listening to Joy 94.9 with The Petri Dish, and that was Two Cents Sideshow with Wishbone.
Right now, we're on to science news, and since our topic for today is the brain, thought we'd focus on some brainy science news.
What do you have for us, Wendy? What brain news do you have?
The travelling tumour is what I call this. Scientists from the University of Heidelberg have found that if cancer cells in the brain don't have a particular type of protein, it may mean that they can't move or metastasize around the brain. They can't spread as well. So this particular protein is actually to blame for tumor cells spreading. And when the protein wasn't functioning properly, cancer cells traveled more effectively through the tissues. So when it wasn't functioning,
these brain cells are inhibited by these protein?
That's right. That's exactly right. So if cancer cells don't have a particular protein, it enables them to move through healthy tissue.
Oh, so they need this protein to stop.
That's right. Exactly. So that's University of Heidelberg is telling
us that. That's not in Melbourne, is it? Where's the University of Heidelberg?
No, that would be in Germany. Is that Heidelberg? Oh, dear. Oh, dear. That's a large city. I should know this.
Yes. Oh, it's just not in the northern suburbs. That's all we need to
do. No. Oh, dear. Well, this one I know. It's Spain. Researchers from Spain have provided evidence that cannabinoids, the active ingredient in marijuana, might kill human brain cancer cells. THC is the active ingredient, and it killed human brain cancer cell lines by encouraging cancer cells to eat themselves up in a process called autophagy.
So they've been smoking cannabis and it...
Mice showed decreased tumour growth when they were given it injected into their brains.
An animal model,
that's right. So this is science news. And maybe one more quick one, since I sort of buggered up the travelling tumour. I don't think I explained that very well at all. But research from Rockefeller University suggests that we don't smell by inhaling the smell all at once, but rather the wind blows the odours in all different directions, leaving it up to the brain to put all the odours back into place.
So our brain's a smell sorting machine.
Exactly. It's sort of like our noses pick up the smells like puzzle pieces and our brains put it all back together.
So our olfactory, which we mentioned a few weeks ago when we were talking about taste buds, is processing all this.
That's right. And telling us what it's most likely that we're smelling. The university that was studying this looked at locusts and they found that there were certain patterns in the brain that were picking up the smells at different times and then your brain would work out.
Another animal model.
Another animal model, which will sit quite nicely as we talk about our controversy on how well animal models are at studying the brain.
Yes, but first we'll have another track. But we'll let your mind settle with all this science news.
That's right. And we've got Oh Yeah by The Greats.
Joy 94.9. A little less straight than other radio stations.
You're listening to The Petri Dish and just then you heard The Greats with Oh Yeah. And right now we're going to talk about the brain more.
Nice work, Jay. We got there. This is Afro Week, so we're just playing all Australian music on The Petri Dish. But forget about that for the moment. Don't forget about everything. We'll be talking about memories a little bit later.
Yes.
But for the moment, animal models as a good weapon to study the brain, is it?
Well, let's talk about the brain in general first. So let's talk about how your brain works. So our brain is made up of not just a brain, the spines and nerves to go with it. And it's controlled by complex systems of both unconscious and unconscious.
Unconscious and unconscious?
Conscious and unconscious, right. Sorry. And so there's things like your unconscious being, things like breathing and your heartbeat. Those things just happen automatically.
Right. Yeah.
And conscious things being talking and smelling and walking and talking. And so these are controlled by different parts of your brain. And it's all controlled by electrochemical signals that are sent by neurons, which Wendy will be talking about a bit later on. And our brain, all animal brains can be broken up in a basic structure of the brain stem, which is where heartbeats and breathing occurs.
So that's where your unconscious measures come from, the brain stem.
Yep. And also things like digesting and your reflexes.
Right, yeah, because we don't control digestion and...
Exactly. So all those things like that we can't control just happens through the brain stem.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the cerebellum, which is in the just behind, just at the really far end of your brain, mm-hmm. so near your spinal cord. And this coordinates your limb movements and it's called your hindbrain.
So this is the part of the brain that looks a bit like porridge.
Yes, right at the back. And then you've got these two things called the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland, which is just above your brain stem.
Okay.
And they control a lot of things such as body temperature, hormones and visceral functions, which is digestion and urination.
Ah, so that makes sense that they sit quite close to the brainstem. Yeah. So they're helping out the brainstem make its unconscious decisions.
And we're talking about addiction. This is where this all happens, this sensory, this sexual response, aggression and pleasure all happen in this little area. It's really tiny, but it does a lot.
It's an exciting area.
Exactly. And then the rest of your brain is called the cerebrum. And it's the rest of your brain and it collects information from your sensory organs, so your hands and your nose and your tongue. It initiates all your motor functions, controls your emotions, holds your memory and thought processes.
Right.
And within that, it also has your visual cortex, so you can see and all those other things.
And that all feeds into then the pituitary gland and the centre of the brain and the brainstem.
Exactly.
So then the brainstem can make decisions.
Yeah, and it's really complex through a whole series of neuron networks.
Mm-hmm.
And to add another complexity on top of that, you have a left and your right brain. So your brain is really a really 3D organ. It doesn't just do one thing. It has a lot of connections. It's really complex. And the left side, you know, you may have heard this before, is most commonly associated with logic, language, facts, details, pattern perception, reality-based things, information, and being practical and safe.
Mm-hmm.
And your right side is associated with creativity, risk-taking, spatial perception, fantasies, imaginations, images, philosophy, and religion.
And if people find themselves more on the creative side of things, they find rather than a logical person, it's not that one size of their brains will physically be larger than the other. It's just that there'll be more neural cells and neural pathways.
Yeah, you just have a stronger neural connection on your right side mm-hmm. of your brain because neurons, you know, when they start developing, form strong connections.
Mm-hmm.
And as we grow older, the more we use a certain part, the stronger the connection will be and other connections will die off.
Okay, excellent. And so this is the same for animals and human animals.
And just a little side fact, even there's really interesting studies with stroke patients who lose one side of their brain. They show the extreme traits of the other. So, for example, if you lost your left side, you have no perception of danger because your right side is just risk-taking and you do things that you wouldn't normally do.
Well, I wonder if there's some sort of, you know, how Capricorns are supposed to be a certain way and Aquarius is supposed to be more risk-taking, and I wonder if there's some with the signs and...
Well, maybe we can do the science behind astrology.
I wonder. It sounds like a bit of a contradiction in terms, though, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does. We're not talking about stars. Anyway, so as we can see, the brain is quite a complex organ.
Mm-hmm.
And the brain is highly protected from diseases, from viruses and bacteria, from infiltrating, and from our brain from decaying. So most brain diseases are actually self-initiated or they're autoimmune.
Mm-hmm.
So scientists think.
So that's our brain malfunctioning on its own. It's not some bacteria that somehow entered the brain and caused damage.
Things like mad cow disease is caused by a virus, and so it's not something like that. It's things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and multiple sclerosis. Never say it properly. Did my last research paper on it. MS. We'll call it MS. Generally, the theory is that they're autoimmune diseases. So, they do with that genetic makeup and environmental factors.
Mm-hmm.
And they are clumped together in a term called neurodegenerative diseases.
Right. So, it's your brain degenerating.
Yep. And this is caused by the deterioration of your nerve cells. And that's not just your brain, also in your spinal cord and obviously around your body.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, how does this... So, you're doing very well, but how does this tell us about animal models?
Animal models. So, well, animal models are used because the brain is quite hard to study in a human because we can't take out a live tissue sample from a brain because we don't know what the effect is going to be. Like, even though we know these different regions of the brain is highly 3D and scientists still haven't gotten to the core of the cerebrum as to what it actually does. So removing certain parts of tissue could have drastic effects. And we don't know that. They don't really want to take that risk because it might cause someone to die or lose speech or something along those lines.
Well, that's right. You can't just grab a volunteer, pay them $50 and take out a part of their brain.
Exactly. And it's really hard to study humans in vivo, like as alive as well, these brains. And that's the real tough thing because Alzheimer's, Parkinson's and MS, as we all know, we do not know the cause of it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know why it happens and we can't study it because the onset of these diseases happen very late in life and the warning signs happen too late because the damage has already been done.
Right.
So we can't track back and that's a problem scientists are having. So scientists then developed, so being really scientific, we need to find the next best thing, which is animals.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I would have thought perhaps it was Republicans.
No, it's animals.
It's animals, right. It's
not Republicans.
Perhaps Republicans are one below the animals. No.
Yeah.
Politics and science should never mix.
Moving on from the Republicans. So the next thing is to look at animals, and animals, there's a whole range of them. You may be thinking to yourself, well, chimpanzees are genetically closely linked to us, but yet again, they have real ethical issues using chimpanzees and primates just because of the way they have real so-called human emotions. I'm not saying that other animals don't have them, but there's real ethical debate into using them. Australia bans using the use of primates, but you can use them in like some Asian countries. But most European countries ban the use of experimental on primates.
Really?
Yeah.
So, is that mainly surgical procedures or any sort of psychological procedure
any
now?
Any sort of, like, I think surgical, medical, anything that induces disease and suffering into these
animals. Okay, but you can do those sort of, hey, Jimmy the chimpanzee, grab this, follow this light. Okay.
Exactly. And so, we usually use rodents such as guinea pigs, mice, rats and rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, they still feel pain and they probably still have emotions as well, but they can't really prove that. Like, whereas, you know, monkeys, they cry and they learn like human children, and that's why they don't use them. And we move to rodents because we don't hear them squeal, basically. This is a bit of my bias in there. So
that's harsh.
It is.
Because they squeak. So they just don't squeal. It's that K to L.
Yeah. They don't complain as much.
Right. Excellent. So I think we can see what side of the fence you're sitting on.
It is controversial. I'm not completely on that side of the fence, but this is for the listeners to decide. So, and the big problem is that in the animal world, the diseases that we experience are not necessarily replicated in the animal world. We have to induce it. So it is not natural to them to have these diseases.
So, mice and guinea pigs do not get MS as far as
they don't get MS, they don't get Alzheimer's, and they don't get Parkinson's.
Is that because they probably don't live as long in order to have these
probably don't live as long, but it's also the same in primates as well. They actually don't develop those diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have to induce it in those animals. And that's a big question as to what causes it, like what happens in our life that causes these diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So animal models are induced. And I'll take an example of MS. Rodents are injected with myelin proteins. Now, myelin is a sheet of fat that covers your neurons,
mm-hmm.
and allows electrical messages to jump across, like to be sent through quite easily.
Your brain. Okay, so it allows electrical signals through the brain.
And the myelin proteins are found on the inside, so your body can't really see them. So your immune system won't be like, I'm going to attack them. But as soon as you inject it into a mice, because it's foreign, because the immune system's never seen these before, recognizes it foreign and starts attacking the myelin in the mice.
Okay, yeah. Yes. And then so it starts attacking both the natural myelin and the myelin that's just been introduced. Okay.
Exactly. And after they've injected it, so the MS starts showing symptoms of classical MS symptoms. Mm-hmm. And one of the big problems is that this is called EAE, it's called experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis, big term there. Yeah. And it's a little bit different from MS because this is based on assumption that MS is caused by the human's immune system not recognizing myelin.
Right. Okay.
All right. So that's another problem with animal models that we only use. The animal models, we create them by having an assumption that that's how it's done. So, we're actually not really learning the real progression of the disease.
Okay, we've made a jump, really, haven't we?
We've made a jump to a conclusion. And yes, they do alter experiments. Like, the introduction of EAE has happened for over 40 years now. It happened in the 1970s first.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from all these experiments and different types of EAE models, they found 70 cures for EAE. But only 4 of them can translate to humans without any consequences. Actually, 3 now, because one of them caused blindness. They found very late on. And only 3 of them can actually help relieve the suffering of MS, not actually cure it.
And in animal models or in mice, it's cured it. Cured in 70% of the... In 70 cases, not percent. In 70 cases... They've been able to cure the animal model.
Oh, not 70 cases. 70 different types of medical treatments have been able to remyelinate. So, the myelin sheaths regrow and they stop demyelinating, which is removing myelin.
Wow. And so, what's the next step then? What do you suggest if obviously this model is not so relatable to the human condition?
I don't have a solution. And that's the big ethical debate we have. Like, these animals are treated very ethically. Like, they have ratings of pain. So, as soon as they reach a pain level of 3.5 to 5, which is quite high, they euthanize the mice or rodents.
Clearly, the left side of the brain has decided that logical 3.5 level of pain.
And, you know, I've worked in a lab where we had to suggest, like, it is quite horrific seeing these mice go through it, through what they go through. And, you know, that's just MS. Like, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's is a whole different ball game because they use different type of mice. MS use just one type.
Mm.
Alzheimer's and Parkinson's use a variety of transgenic mice, so mice with different genes. And that adds another layer because humans may not necessarily express the same mutant in their DNA.
And so is the rate of... Because you said that... We've come up with all these solutions to the model for mice. So we can induce disease in mice and we can cure it, thinking that we're curing a similar MS. Is that the same with Parkinson's and with Alzheimer's? Have we induced those diseases in mice and then been able to cure them in mice, but not in humans, obviously?
Not actually cure them in mice, but see the pathology a bit more. And have some relief, have some medication to relieve that. And I think with Parkinson's, there is some sort of cures for those mice. But in humans, just because, you know, because they breed specifically that genetics of mice, that genes of mice, that may only represent 10% of the whole Parkinson's population. So not helping the whole disease. And we're also not really understanding the whole disease as well, because it's still based on a presumption that this is how it all works. And that's the problem scientists are having is... Well, how do we actually know how it works when we can't study in humans and we can only study it post-mortem when it's too late and you can only see damaged cells? And from that, we can only create hypotheses. And the mice aren't showing the same thing. So it's quite the big, giant ethical debate, because my lecturer who was running my lab has a giant problem with this, because she's been doing it for over 30 years. And she's like, you know, we keep going around in circles and the suffering of these mice just keep going on. And when does the madness end?
Oh, dear. Stuart Little is crying right now.
Yeah. So there we go. Animal models, they can be helpful, but are they
really?
There
are some problems.
There are some big problems with them.
Well, we're going to have a song. And up next, we're going to talk about what is a neuron. And that's part of Do You Remember This Scientific Fact from high school. So hopefully, once we've covered this, all will be clear about how the brain works and whether mice and animal models really are the key to understanding MS. And if you have any questions about today's show, do SMS on 0427 JOY 949, or if you've got any questions of any similar issues or anything that you'd like us to answer.
And you can also email onair@joy.org.au, or if you've got one later, you can also email thepetridish@joy.org.au. But yes, first another track.
Let Joy keep you company online. Joy.org.au, wherever you are.
You're listening to The Petri Dish on Joy 94.9, and today we are talking about the brain, how the brain works, controversies associated with studying the brain.
Yes.
And right now, we like to talk about...
What is a neuron?
What is a neuron? My brain just stopped working second there.
Your memory's gone, which is a segue into our next... After that, anyway.
Can you have a segue into a segue? Oh, there's too much going on. This is crazy.
Brain overload.
We have a segment on this show, is what I was trying to say, called Remember This Scientific Fact from School, something that perhaps you learnt in high school and have just forgotten, or a buzzword that people keep talking about and you think, I really don't know what that is. So today, it's neuron. What exactly is it?
Yeah, you heard about demyelinating neurons?
Go into the details. And a neuron, it's actually a nerve cell. So sort of like there's skin cells around and heart cells. A neuron is a nerve cell, so it can conduct electricity. And electricity is what runs the brain. So an electrical impulse sends information through the brain and it gets picked up by sort of one arm of a nerve cell. Imagine a nerve cell or a neuron, kind of like a spider. So it's got the cell body and it's got sort of these eight arms. Now, a nerve cell has not an infinite amount of arms, but different nerve cells have different amounts of arms. And there's two different types. There's dendrites and there's axons. And the dendrites will send off messages.
Yes.
Correct? Yeah. And the axons will pick up messages. No, the dendrites let in impulses. Oh, dear.
Oh, dear, Wendy, you're getting your facts mixed up.
We're all getting everything mixed up. The brain is a complicated organ, but this is not complicated. Dendrites let impulses come into the cell. So they invite...
Mm-hmm.
the electrical impulse into the cell, and axons then let the impulses go out, and they sort of pass the electrical signal onto a new nerve cell. So, and that's how things go from one side of your brain to another, or from one side of the brain down into the spinal cord.
So let me get this clear. There's little spider fingers.
Yes.
That goes, hello.
That's right. And this is the dendrites that say hello. Electrical impulse.
Welcome to my cell body. And then they pass it through there.
I can't believe you've sexualized nerve cells.
And they pass it through and leaves through the axon.
That's right.
So thank you for visiting. Now, goodbye.
That's right. Goodbye. And then a new dendrite from a nearby nerve cell will pick up that electrical signal. And then we'll pass it on. And that's how messages get sent. And that's how... the one part of your brain will say, arms, move. And then that gets sent all the way down to your arms, into the muscles in your arms to say, contract, expand. That's right. And so neurons pass on and receive information using both electrical signals and chemical messengers.
Yes.
So if the neurons are too far away from each other, or perhaps the way that they're structured means that an electrical signal can't pass effectively between the two. So maybe the axons and the dendrites are too far apart. Then they need to use chemicals. And so famous chemicals are endorphins and dopamine that you might have heard of. And this is where the axons actually sort of release this chemical, and then the dendrites of another neuron will pick up that signal. Wow. And that's how neurons and electrical impulses get sent throughout the brain.
So not all neurons are close together, because my picture is that neurons are always close together, but there are also some that are really far apart.
That's right. There's ones with very long arms, with long dendrites and long axons, and then there's one with short as well. And so this will also depend on how strong the electrical signal is and how weak it is.
Wow.
That's right. Now, unlike other cells in the body, neurons actually stop reproducing shortly after birth. So neurons that die are not replaced, which is why there are a lot of neurodegenerative disorders such as MS and Parkinson's, because unlike your skin cells, that when neurons start breaking down, they actually won't be reproduced.
Yes, exactly. And you were born with more neurons than we need. And as we grow older, if we don't use those connection and those pathways, they disappear as well.
That's right. That's right. Well, so another thing is that when neurons get to talking, which is that's when they start sending electrical signals to each other, it's sort of like a highway being built. And the more times that your axons are collecting electricity and sending off electricity, then the more they get used to this pathway, kind of like you driving home using a highway. And once you sort of get used to that pathway, then that's how electrical signals build up in the brain. And it means that's how you learn habits and you develop memory. It's all about creating these electrical signals.
Yeah, they're quite the amazing cell. And that's why a lot of research goes into stem cells, because if we can keep regenerating our neurons, the potential will be endless.
Exactly.
And yeah, that's all we have, neurons. And before, if you're confused about myelin before, myelin insulates the axons to help those electrical impulses go through. I was going to add that little side note.
I like that side note. So just remember, dendrites let the impulses come into the cell, axons out.
There you go.
So what's an axon? Now we know. I was just going to play
it. And there we go. Hope you that refreshed your memory of high school. And now we're going to play another track.
That's right.
After these messages. And that was just a taster of what's coming up next, which was the presets. But before that, we heard Qua with Circles. And Wendy and I imagine that's what neurons sound like.
That's right, sending little message to each other.
Sending little message in that those funky twos. That was Qua, who's also an Australian-based artist.
That's right. Now you're listening to The Petri Dish on Joy 94.9. And today we're busting the myth that when you hit your head, it can cause brain damage.
Can it cause brain damage? Because that's how I thought Muhammad Ali, became brain damaged, was because of those hits to the head.
That's the common belief, but he's actually got Parkinson's disease. So that's a neurodegenerative disorder that's caused by your neurons dying off.
So I've been lied to this whole time.
Well, actually, I didn't find any research on Muhammad Ali specifically.
Perhaps. Well, it's hard to study because he's still alive.
So. That's right.
So I want him to die, but he's still alive.
So perhaps the reasons why he has brain injury might be different to everyone else's. But there's actually not that much strong evidence that shows that getting hit in the head from boxing causes brain injury. So they've done quite a lot of studies on it. And there was a review done very recently this year that sort of had the conclusion that there was reasonable clinical and radiological evidence that long-term bangs to the head or head trauma could cause brain injury. And so it occurs in 10 to 20% of professional boxers. But in a lot of the CT scans and looks into the brain, there's not really any consistent evidence that if you were hit in the head quite often through your boxing career, you have more brain injury than other sufferers. And there were some studies in 2007, a study revealed that amateur boxers after a fight had a greater, they had a lot more proteins in the brain that are associated with causing brain injury.
Oh, wow.
And so they looked at, they took the fluid that flows throughout the brain, it's called cerebrospinal fluid, and they tested it for the types of proteins that are released after a fight. But after 3 months of not fighting, then their brain and the fluid within the brain, all the proteins went back to normal. And so they don't actually know the long-term effects of fighting and whether really one bang to the head will cause brain damage. And there's not even a lot of evidence as to why if you bang your head, it seems like little neurons would be dying intuitively. It seems like trouble would be struck. Yeah. Because unlike if you bruise yourself, your skin cells can grow again. Your neurons can't grow again. So there's some theories out there that, like we were talking about before, how your neurons send messages through electrical signals. Mm-hmm. And that's a very complex pathway. What is an electrical signal? It's all about getting charges, positive and negative, sending it through. Yeah. And your brain passes through positive and negative atoms through these little channels, like potassium channels and iron channels. Exactly. And so they think that if you bang your head or your head gets banged by someone quite often, then those channels will become a bit defunct. And they think potassium channels particularly might not be able to control positive and negative charges. And so you might not be able to control electrical impulses.
After we're getting hit in the head or while we're getting hit in the head?
After we're getting, I think the result of getting hit in the head.
But then we have our skull as well. Isn't there a little bit of a gap between our skull and our brain protecting it, so therefore we're actually just beating up the skull and not the brain? Was there anything research on that? That's my hypothesis, actually.
That it's beating up the skull. Well, I guess that would eventually...
Because
you're still sort of shaking around the brain exactly, there. Like, true. You've still got to be Princess and the Pea style. You still feel the pee,
even there's a layer, and there's a layer of brain, because you know it takes quite a high impact to create that, to break your skull, for example, in the car accidents you have your brain injury.
That's right.
Quite high impact. So, do they find that the box that a hit from being hit in the face the same impact? If I had the same impact as a car with my fist,
they haven't done such conclusive studies, because they mainly just take boxers who have been in their career for sort of 15 years and then study the incidence of brain injury and the effect of the brain on those boxers. So they wouldn't exactly measure different punches. They haven't done that yet, but perhaps they should. And traumatic head injury has been known to increase the risk of Alzheimer's, but not other brain disorders such as Parkinson's and motor neuron disease.
I always find that a lot of things can increase the chance of Alzheimer's. Do you ever find that?
Well, I think living generally increases the incidence of Alzheimer's. Well, maybe because we know a little bit more about it, and so we know exactly what increases the chances, because we can sort of see it coming in a way. But whereas with diseases that they just have an onset and we don't know where they came from, we can't pick the risk. It could be that.
Could be that. So nice. Getting my head hit once right now. So if you took this computer and hit it on my head, my brain would get damaged.
Well, the studies are fairly inconclusive, but they're definitely not as conclusive as common knowledge, so to speak, would say. Everyone has a theory. Oh, if you get punched, neurons damaging. I've got an exam tomorrow. I can't have my neurons damaged. And the studies are not so conclusive. So yes, if I hit you on the head, you know, just maybe no brain damage. Not.
I think I want to put this in: more research required by scientists to actually sort this out.
That is, if you have an opinion on whether you think that getting punched in the face, punched in the head, any head bashing of any sort will cause brain injury or perhaps increase your chances of brain injury, do SMS on 0427JOY949.
Yeah, or email onair@joy.org.au.
That's right. And up next, after this track, you're going to be hearing about a movie. We're going to be debunking the movie Spotless Mind, or
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, a great classic film about memory.
That's right. And we'll be talking about can you delete your memories. But first, we're going to hear Eucalyptus by The Presets.
You're listening to Joy 9.9 with The Petri Dish. And we've been talking about the brain today. We talked about how the brain works, some controversies with animals. Talked about a neuron, and also can knocking my head actually cause brain damage, and
Doesn't look like it
it's
can.
It's inconclusive.
Inconclusive is really what we should say as safety. Right now we're going to be talking about deleting memories. And is it possible? Because in a certain movie, they could.
Yeah, so Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is kind of like a Romeo and Juliet. They're two star-crossed lovers and they just want to forget each other. So they go to this clinic to erase their memory of just that other person.
That's right. And they don't want to forget anything else.
So there's a few questions that we're going to answer here. Can I erase my memory? And can I erase just one person from my memory? Can it happen, Wendy?
Interesting. You tell me, Shane.
Well, memory is quite complex. So scientists used to think that memory was stored in your hippocampus. Mm-hmm. But they've actually found that the memory is stored around your brain.
So they used to think there was one spot that was the memory spot.
Yes. But it's actually in different areas. And that's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind actually portrays that. They actually say that that these memories are kept in different parts of your brain. So the emotional side and the physical side of memory. So physical, like touch, is kept separate from like falling in love with someone.
Okay, so if my dad makes a really good cake or something and I remember the smell in the smelling part of the brain and I'll remember the look of that cake in my eyes or in my sensory area. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. So it's actually spread out. It's not in just one section where, cake, and put that in the cake memory section of my brain. No, it doesn't work like that. It's to do with your visual everything.
And your taste. And when you right.
Exactly. And that is created by the neurons we were talking about before. And our memories are created by neurons forming connections with each other, sending messages to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so the longer we keep remembering these memories and retrieving them, the stronger these connections are. So for things like remembering that we need to go to the toilet when we need to go to the toilet or remembering to eat, these connections are there to make sure that we remember to do these things. And then we may store in your long-term memory.
Okay. And so that could mean that theoretically, if you knew what those pathways were, you could delete those single pathways and then I could forget that cake. Is that correct?
Yeah, but the trouble is, how are you going to find the neuron pathways? Neuroscience has not gotten that far as to finding exact neuron pathways to delete the one person.
Because there's 100 billion different neurons, aren't there, out there?
Exactly.
So that means what? It's 100 billion times 100 billion connections. And you'd have to try and find one to delete one.
Yeah, and it's quite difficult. And, you know, we're not just... The movie is quite accurate in the fact that they couldn't delete the person because they had emotional responses to trigger off the memory of the physical person. And so it's all kind of interlinked as well. So, because in the end, they remember each other. Is that right? I'm pretty sure that's right.
That's right, without giving away anything. That is so interesting, though, about memory, because do you find that perfume will linger off? Because I think there's only about 5 perfumes that guys will use.
Yeah.
And when you're walking in the street and you smell a perfume of either a friend or a partner and it just automatically elicits this reaction to them.
And I found it really weird. Like, with talking about perfume, my coworker, she bought Jean Paul Gaultier, so what I wear sometimes at work. And she's like, I love it so much. I bought it for my boyfriend. But she's like, every time I smell it, though, I think of you.
Yeah, that's right. So you would have to be able to delete that smell of this perfume.
You'd have to delete a lot of things.
Which is what they did try and do in the movie. You had to try and bring everything, photos of them, smells of them. And then that's how they tried to pinpoint what areas of the brain were lighting up. But you would have to somehow know that this is the area of the brain that is smelling versus this is the area of the brain that is smelling a particular thing. Otherwise, you could delete your whole ability to smell.
Exactly. And that's a real difficulty in that, because we don't really understand the brain that well to start playing around and altering things and erasing memory.
But in theory, in the great world of science fiction, believe it could happen?
I've actually read a few articles that it actually could happen in the next 10 to 20 years. You could actually start erasing certain memories and traumatic experiences from our minds.
Wow.
So it's quite an interesting time in this of neuropsychology.
But I think those studies are talking about exactly as you said, it's a traumatic incident rather than perhaps knowing a person for however long a relationship is, 2-3 years. might be more difficult to erase a person as opposed to an incident, but maybe not.
Maybe not. The answer is not clear, but, you know, The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is a great movie. You should definitely go see it. But it does give a great lesson in memory that it is stored in different parts. But the only real flaw is that we're not at the stage of erasing memory, and it's just too hard. And actually, in truth, do actually say it's too hard to erase one memory because it is so complex. So it is kind of a truthful movie.
Excellent.
Kind of science.
I love that movie. So science fact versus over science fiction. Excellent. Well, that's all we have time for on the Petri Dish today. Next week, we're going to be talking about carbon.
Yes, and that was suggested by our fan, Lonnie. He suggested water. I know he wants to know about carbon.
That's right. And carbon, everyone's talking about it, but do you know what it is?
Yes, and we're not going to talk carbon in the sense of heating up, which is also on Joy Monday, so the environment show. We're going to take a different twist on carbon.
Yeah, so have a listen. 10 p.m. on a Tuesday.
And remember, if you have anything you'd like to say about the show, feel free to email us at thepetridish@joy.org.au. It's time to say goodbye. And thank you for listening to The Petri Dish. Be sure to join us next week. And today's show is brought to you by the letters NA and the number 11. Have a good night.
Have a good night.
For more information and the latest science updates, you can check out the blog or more podcasts at joy.org.au/thepetridish.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.